Welcome to the Safe and Sound Protocol podcast, a polyvagal theory-informed therapy. I'm your host, Joanne McIntyre. Here we talk everything polyvagal and SSP related. Dr. Porges has provided us with a revolutionary framework for understanding the connection between our autonomic nervous system and behavior. The SSP acoustic intervention is an exciting new therapy helping people all around the world.
Hi and welcome to episode number 12. Today we are also lucky to be hearing the wise words from Kim Barthel again. Kim spoke with me previously in episode number 9, and in episode 9 we spoke about the importance of relationships in developing resilience. We also spoke about key factors in creating attuned relationships, especially being able to self-regulate. In quoting Kim, "The only one you can change is yourself." And Kim speaks about how to do that so you can better help others. In today's episode, Kim discusses her workshop, Exploring and Applying Psychosensory Interventions in Trauma-Informed Practice. Welcome and thank you for joining me to talk about your work. I know you have quite a few different workshops, but I've selected this one to sort of first to start with, because I think, you know, with the current state of the world, that trauma is really going to permeate into so many different family dynamics and healthcare just globally. So I think this particular topic of your workshop, I think, provides some really valuable tools to people providing support and to families as well. So the topic of the workshop is psychosensory intervention, informed and integrated mental health support strategies for the treatment of trauma, providing an integrated theoretical connection about the neurological interplay between attachment, developmental trauma, and sensory processing issues. So definitely very important topics. So I thought maybe we'd start with, you know, how do you define trauma?
Wow, what a great question. When I think about the word trauma, it's in the eye of the perceiver. And what is traumatic to one is different for each person. And so I think of it as a stress response that takes you outside of the window of tolerance, takes you outside of your capacity to contain your bucket of chemistry that is your individualized stress response. And for me, I define trauma in so many different ways, in that there are different types of trauma. There's shock trauma, which is typically an event or an experience that takes you outside of your reality. And then I think of my passion, which is a strange word to use when you think about talking about trauma, passion. Developmental trauma, which is trauma that happens in the context of interpersonal relationships in childhood. And this is a traumatic alteration of one's developing brain. And that changes how you interface or interact with the environment and can show up in so many different facets of human function. And then there's complex trauma, which is an interaction of those two things, a combination of that shock trauma layered on top of developmental trauma. And sometimes it results in acute post-traumatic stress disorder, and sometimes it doesn't. But what is more of a mystery to me is actually resilience compared to what trauma, when we think about trauma, what actually makes people resilient? And I'm reading this beautiful book at this moment called In My Grandmother's Hands. I have to make sure I get the title right. It's about racial trauma. And
I've heard of that one mentioned before in another. Yeah. So you're really enjoying it?
Oh, it's got me absolutely totally connected to it in such a deep facet of thought process and reflection, because what it is reminding me of is the transgenerational transmission of trauma. I just want to make sure I have the title right here. My Grandmother's Hands.
My Grandmother's
Hands. And the author is Rezma Menachem. Rezma Menachem.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she talks all about not only is transgenerational transmission of trauma a thing, but that there is transgenerational transmission of resilience, which is such a beautiful combination of our genes, our environment, our relationships, our temperament. All of these interacting pieces make up how we cope with the facets of our experience. There is one more trauma I'm going to add to the list for right now, and that's collective trauma. And given that we are so fully immersed in it, given COVID-19, it's something that I refer to all day long as a collective experience that bounces around even energetically between us. So there are multiple layers to that. Aren't you glad you asked that very simple question? What is trauma? Mm-hmm. And how we think about how it interacts at so many different levels.
But I think it's important to expand that definition of trauma. I think often it's held in that traditional viewpoint of neglect or abuse or, you know, the excessive traumatic event, when trauma is the individualized response. It's unique to each individual. And then for people to think about, you know, people often get caught up in diagnoses, but think that, you know, individuals, you know, who do have neurodevelopmental diagnoses are essentially, you know, dealing with developmental trauma as well.
If you think about the true neurobiological components of trauma, the amygdala has so much to do with it. And so many of our kids with neurodiversity, they find the fluffies in their socks a trauma.
Exactly.
So that's why I say it's in the eye of the perceiver.
And it'll be so nice that we get to a day where we talk more about the neurobiology of the impact of events rather than getting caught up in the diagnoses.
Oh.
No, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Yes, Joanne. I'm flapping. This is a podcast, so people can't see the flap.
Recording. This will go up on YouTube as well. So yeah.
Okay. Of the collaborative enthusiasm at that particular idea that, you know, we are so much bigger than a diagnosis.
Yes. Yeah. So fantastic definition. So the next definition I'd love for us to explore is sensory processing. You know, we know that we have a lot of OTs who listen in, but we have a lot of practitioners across different mental health arenas and families. So I think sort of describing sensory processing, and I know as we talk, we're going to connect that into the layer of the neurobiology of what that trauma, underlying trauma, and how that can then, in fact, impact our sensory system. So,
wow, you know, the minute you asked for that definition, I reflected all the way back to 1980, I'm not saying what year, when I was a student of Jean Ayres and falling in love with the concept of sensory integration and listening to the formal definition of what is sensory integration. The ability to put together all the different senses to make sense out of the experience that we have. And that was such a cognitive definition in those times. Now, all these years later, it is such a profound understanding of how our entire experience of living relies on how our senses take in the information from outside of us, from within us as well, and put it together in our brain and in our body to make sense out of our life's experience. So to me, sensory processing is how do I, and the word process means take in, put together, and make sense out of all of the different bytes of data that come into my brain through my different sensory organs. And it's critical for all aspects of human function. I hope that was a good definition.
No, very good, very good. And I haven't released it yet, but I did a discussion last week with Michael Graziano,
yes,
from Princeton, talking about peripersonal space. Yes. So I think what you just said will layer on top of how he talks about how we process sensory, visual, tactile, and auditory within our peripersonal space, and how that is basically integrated on top of our vestibular system, which I know we're going to talk about too, but to really let us know where we are and how we interact with the world. And if that is deficit in some sort of way, that our whole being is impacted.
Profoundly.
Yes, yes, yes. So our sensory system is an important one to tap into in the therapeutic process. And I think even more so when we layer it on top of how that gets impacted if there is an underlying neurobiological impact from a stressor, trauma, if you want to sort of say. So talk a little bit about how that system can be impacted.
Well, I think if you think for a minute about attachment, which is another mysterious word, but to me, it is simply the process of connection, of gleaming and beaming between a caregiver and their child. And the entire experience is sensory. So how the rhythms of relationship evolve, I call it serve and return, like tennis. Back and forth between an infant and their caregivers, it's coded in the brain visually, auditorily, tactually, vestibularly, proprioceptively, olfactory. It's an entire sensory experience that becomes associated with comfort, with soothing, with care. So this sensory holistic event of love becomes paired with this person, and I learn and develop a neural network in my brain that these sensations are what it feels like in my body to feel safe. Or as Dr. Porges would say, the development of neuroception.
Mm-hmm.
How do I recognize the sensory feeling interoceptively and exteroceptively of safety and comfort? So the brain is also highly designed to survive. And in the absence of those cues, or when those cues are out of sync or exaggerated or not connected to my communication as an infant, I also code that through my sensory systems. The facial expressions, the tones of voice, the roughness of touch, the lack of touch, the asynchronous movements, these are all then implicit means not recallable, implicitly coded within my being, and I relate that to what relationships mean. And that kind of sets the stage for me as to how I'm going to perceive or anticipate relationships in my future until I learn something new. Mm-hmm. So interpersonal trauma, developmental trauma, is a highly sensory experience and can alter my priorities of how I'm going to deal with my environment. Because if I'm very focused on staying safe, I'm not going to have the ability to be curious, explore, advance my executive functions to the same capacity. So you can see how it sort of changes the trajectory of my developmental being.
Very nice. And also how then, based on those perceptions of safety and looking out for other possible threats, how certain components of that sensory system can become sensitized.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And vigilant.
Mm-hmm.
Or numb.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Completely shut down.
Mm-hmm.
Dependent on my history of experience.
Mm-hmm.
I just listened to Dr. Bruce Perry the other day
mm-hmm.
talk about how in his recent research, he discovered that early developmental trauma has the greatest impact on two things, self-regulation and sensory integration.
Mm.
And I was like, wow, thank you for speaking that out loud.
Mm-hmm.
Things that OTs see every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really interesting to see that be validated.
Yes.
Transdisciplinary mm-hmm. research to show us mm-hmm. that we are seeing and noticing it across the lifespan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And research is helping us appreciate yes. that.
It's interesting you share that. I get emails from the Autism Research, I think it's Institute. I know it's REI, A-R-I. And they had a recent webinar talking about sensory integration, which I just thought was lovely, because there's certainly within Australia some controversy around sensory integration, sensory processing, that sort of clear definitions and what it is. And so it was so nice to see such a big prestigious organization mm. offering a webinar to learn about sensory integration and what that is. Mm-hmm. Very cool. So in your training, you also talk about, you know, things that, you know, attendees will learn, but I like how you use, when you talk about attachment, how you talk about it being functionally adaptive.
Mm.
That maybe sort of describe what that is. Mm. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm going to give a shout out mm-hmm. to my mentor, Dr. Patricia Crittenden.
Mm-hmm.
And in the development of her model of attachment, which is called the developmental maturational model of attachment, her biggest contribution, I feel, to the attachment field is that every strategy that we acquire is an adaptive response to protect ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that because it so powerfully reduces shame, reduces the feelings of it's my fault. When you can see how I adopted this way of being to do my best,
mm-hmm.
to stay safe in this relationship. And, you know, in the book that I wrote, Conversations with the Rattlesnake, with Theo Fleury, one of the things that he speaks about is that was the greatest game changer for him, was realizing how his behavior, which he had always shamed himself for,
mm-hmm.
his addiction, his relational issues, that they were a form of taking care of myself. And I think that reaches into people's hearts and minds and begins a really profound healing opportunity. So when I think about attachment, which can change across your lifespan, because we are so changeable mm-hmm. and neuroplastic, that, you know, we acquired the skills that we have to respond to the environment that we're in. Mm-hmm. And that's how I see attachment as valuable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that layers perfectly on top of polyvagal theory mm-hmm. and how our autonomic nervous system responds, you know, from a bio, if we add another deeper layer to what's happening underneath attachment, is how our autonomic nervous system is responding based on perceptions of threat. And it is, it's an adaptive survival biological response to perceived threat.
May I speak about that for just a second mm-hmm. in conversation mm-hmm. with you? Because mm-hmm. I've been eager to have this wee little bite with you.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I know is that one of the earliest dialing up and dialing down of the autonomic nervous system happens in the context of attachment. That when a caregiver picks up their baby and they make these big eyes, and they say, "Hi, baby," and they are what I call giving a sympathetic nervous system hit
mm-hmm.
to that brain, maximizing interest, availability, and attention. But if that is sustained for too long, then the baby's threshold is superseded and they move outside the window of tolerance and they start to disconnect, dissociate, and the baby will naturally gaze avert,
mm-hmm.
may naturally yawn, may naturally squiggle and squirm as a way of reorganizing their nervous system, bringing online a parasympathetic support to dial back down into that homeostasis.
Mm-hmm.
And a very attuned caregiver does this dance with the baby.
Mm-hmm.
Will say, "Oh, what's that grumpy face? Oh, here, let me pick you up and hold you close."
Mm-hmm.
And so you see the soundboard moving up and down.
Mm-hmm.
Second by second, within this attachment, that is really, to me, such a beautiful example of modulation of the autonomic nervous system in such an elegant way. And over time, the baby broadens their window of tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
It's like they carry their caregiver with them in their head.
Mm-hmm.
And this window gets bigger and bigger and bigger, which is what I call resilience. So I really think about that autonomic nervous system dialogue as being so expansive,
mm-hmm.
especially initially in the context of relationship. So I wanted to talk about that with you
mm-hmm.
as such a brilliant expert that you are in the autonomic nervous system and what you think about what I just said.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm a brilliant expert, but I've definitely done some reading, so that was very flattering. But I think what you just said is perfect. And I know when I was very first sort of learning polyvagal, you almost sort of felt like there was these divisions between your ventral vagal, sympathetic, and dorsal. And I know from speaking to practitioners that they also get caught up in this, you're either in one or the other. But you just said it perfectly. It's a dance. It's pure, and you're using both at the same time for homeostasis.
Mm.
So and we need sympathetic activity.
Mm.
It's not bad. We need it too. So we've got some get up and go. Like right now I'm talking and I've got some sympathetic activity happening, but I perceive safety. I'm getting cues of we're in this safe relationship, talking from you, from your smiles, from your voice. So I keep containment of my sympathetic in with my ventral vagal to keep it safe and regulated. So it is this dance within our bodies, totally. So definitely what you said is a beautiful example, but from that early developmental period, mm-hmm. I think it more so that connection and an attuned parent and how that can play perfectly to help expand that window of tolerance and build that resilience, or if there is that disconnect where you don't pick up those cues of safety, sympathetic system does escalate or move to dorsal vagal, and you get that resilience part of the autonomic nervous system that we see play out in attachment and behaviours become impacted. So, you know, I thank you for bringing that, because it is a dance of homeostasis between sympathetic and parasympathetic systems. Yeah, definitely. And I think this might lead into, I'm sure in your workshop you talk more about this dance in early development, but using relational attunement as a practitioner, because that's part of the dance as well of being attuned with our clients. So what kind of things do you talk about in your workshop to help clue attendees into that, or if there's parents attending as well, what kind of things do you talk about?
Well, attunement is a continuum skill. Forgive me for just a sec, I'm going to clear my voice. Funny that one of the things that happens when you're talking about something important and the vagal nerve becomes interrupted is one of the first things to go is your voice. So I'm paying attention to that in this moment. But attunement is, to me, putting your mind in the mind of the other, which means knowing yourself, which is hard work.
Mm-hmm.
That whole Freudian concept of transference and counter-transference. What's mine? What's yours? What it's that continuously evolving self-understanding. I listened to Bessel van der Kolk yesterday in a very, matter-of-fact manner, say.
That's what I love about him.
I know.
I would love to meet him one day, because I'm sure when you hear him so often, you probably almost feel like you have this sort of, like, I know you, but I just don't know, he just says it as it is.
And I chuckled because he said, you know, this is not about the therapist being nice. Because, you know, your dad could have molested you and 5 minutes earlier have been nice. I'm quoting him right now. And so it's about the therapist reading you. What do you need? And I thought, you know, we talk all about therapeutic use of self, and that can be highly misunderstood as excessive kindness, compassion. But if I move into that space, I can really irritate you if I do it with the wrong client.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about all my aloof teenage street kids who, you know, if I came off as very, you know, soothing, and they would tell me where to stick that. So it's really about who's in front of me and what nonverbal cues are they giving to me? Are they activated? And this takes a lot of practice, because first of all, if I take your behavior personally, then I may not be able to stay available for you. So I have to know myself. What are my own triggers? And I don't even like using that word anymore, because recently, as I've been using the word trigger, it triggers people. So what are my own activating points? Mm-hmm. Things that create activation for me. And, you know, so I have had the opportunity of co-facilitating with lots of different people with different styles. And I'm thinking about one particular very wondrous therapist in this moment who just cuts it like a knife. You need X.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, wow, that was pretty direct. Sometimes that is exactly what the person needs.
Mm-hmm.
So the attunement process is both intuitive but also a skill set of what do I see, feel, and track. Tracking is watching the person's body, watching their breath, watching their shoulders, watching their head position, watching their feet. Those are all parts of things that I'm really interested in. What does the body tell me? Mm-hmm. And it's not about feeling safe with me. It's about you learning to feel safe in yourself. And I may get that started, but ultimately, you're not going to take me with you. Mm-hmm. So it's this attunement and offering to the other. So there's always the possibility to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. I always say when it works, it's treatment. When it doesn't, it's assessment. Mm-hmm. And that's even more valuable. And I'm going to use the word psychotherapeutically because then you have an opportunity for repair. Mm-hmm. And that's where the greatest learning happens. Mm-hmm. Is when things don't go well. And you go back and you show up anyway. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So attunement is, it's a life skill, mm-hmm, that each one of us practice, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, with our clients.
Mm-hmm. So when you're training, how do you kind of help to cue attendees into that? You know, would you sort of, do you run some sort of exercises? I mean, what, mm-hmm, kind of things do you do?
Well, you know, there are different levels, mm-hmm, right? We have in our repertoire, I say we because there are three of us at Relationship Matters here. We have a repertoire of, we call it trauma-informed practice 1, 2, and 3. Mm-hmm. And at trauma-informed practice 1, it's like an exposure to these ideas and these concepts. And you get a chance to look at examples, mm-hmm, of what do these nonverbal cues look like? For example, you know, there are 7 universal facial expressions. Now there are 8, actually. And they're called micro-expressions. And they happen so fast that most of us don't catch them. But you can train yourself to learn them. And this is the work of Paul Ekman. And, you know, almost all of us have a blind spot. And that says a lot about each one of us. So within our training, you know, at level 1, you're getting exposure to the idea that this is even a thing. Mm-hmm. At level 2, it's what's happening to me. Mm-hmm. And at level 3, it's kind of like feedback. What did you see? What could you do different? We, you know, sometimes take a case, and then we go into a breakout room. I'm talking in the Zoom world now because, you know, we've been doing this long before Zoom. But in the Zoom world now, we go into a breakout room and we do some problem solving and people talk about what they see, what they think they would do, what were their individual activating points. And so, you know, you work through those experiences, mm-hmm, in different ways over time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very cool. And just a layer on top of that, which I know you brought up neuroception earlier, that sort of subconscious processing of that our brain is always looking at before, under our awareness of people's body language and their facial expression, but to tune into those micro aspects helps you, yeah, tune into more of those neuroceptive kind of components. And then I know in some of my reading, looking at heart rate variability, that there is research talking about the electromagnetic fields that, yeah, emanate out from our heart's beat, and how this field actually extends a couple of feet out from us, and they've actually measured like emotional intent on that. So it does, our state does resonate out to others. So being able to tune into that, but I think being aware, so aware of where you're at, is really important, and an important skill for, you know, practitioners, but a good one for parents to tune into as well. Mm-hmm.
You know what? I did this lecture last week called Becoming Your Best Self. You and I talked about that one before too, but it's a pretty common one that people love. And one of the things I found myself saying last week was, wow, becoming your best self can really sound like a lot of pressure. That then actually stops you from being your best self. So,
yeah, well said.
The authenticity and the vulnerability and the willingness, you use the word intention, those are very much a part of creating safety. It's not about this perfection of what is it that I see and what do I do with myself, and because that's very cortical. It's the, oh geez, I just screwed that up, or this is very hard for me right now because I'm feeling uncertain of what to say. You know, what a beautiful connecting point that is. So I think authenticity and vulnerability, Brené Brown thinking, really allows us to model and generate a sense of comfort.
Yeah, lovely. Another thing I would love for you to talk about that you touch on in your workshop is how trauma impacts postural control.
Well, you know, my lifelong career of neurodevelopmental treatment instructor has made me pay attention to muscles and the postural system and how we move through space and how movement is actually an aspect of emotional expression. That our physical body, our fascia, our motor system, is a representation of our history. That what you see in this being, in my motor system, is a chronological history of the way that I used my muscles within the context of my environment. The relationship being part of my environment. So I've been very interested throughout my career as to what happens when I'm emotionally dysregulated to the motor system. Because, you know, as a, if I put the motor system in the front and I forget about regulation back here and just focus on movement, I'm missing how interactive they are. That you don't learn movement unless you are motivated, connected, available, present. That the brain learns things as a big picture. So when kids, you know, when I worked with children with cerebral palsy and they were sad or unhappy or frustrated, early on, we didn't always attune to that. And just believed, you know, you have to repetition, practice, rehearsal. Let's just get it done so that the body will learn. But now that we understand, of course, neurologically so much better how interactive all these pieces are, well, you know, my clients taught me that. When they felt safe, when they felt, when they believed in themselves, you could see the difference in their coordination system, in their engagement with their body in the environment. But, you know, specifically to answer your question in a very specific way, when we are in a dorsal vagal space, we deactivate much of the tone in our postural system. So there is a very strong correlation physiologically between our vagal system and the inner core, musculature, because the respiratory diaphragm, the pelvic floor, these muscles, which are a part of your inner core stability, they receive input from the vagal system. I use that word in a big picture way. Mm-hmm. And including, you know, that the vagus nerve, of course, that makes it all the way to the pelvic floor, has some sympathetic fibers in it.
Mm-hmm.
Not all parasympathetic. So I think that, you know, things like toileting and continence and all these pieces of our interior being, which are also reliant upon those muscles inside of us. And we now know that your inner core is your anticipatory postural control system. So if my state of regulation literally is in survival, I can't use my core for posture because I'm holding my breath to survive. I can't use my muscles for my postural system. So progressively over time, we see a person who's in survival lose the actions that those muscles are intended for. And so this is very important for therapists because we often say, that kid has low tone.
Mm-hmm.
Look at their postural system. And I have the question mark of, that kiddo is in deactivation.
Mm-hmm.
They've had so much stress that their system is lost some of its capacity for stability.
Mm-hmm.
So that's mm-hmm. one quick example.
Mm-hmm. And that's, I just wanted to add, because you're giving the example of children, but mm-hmm. exactly into adults. And so when you have, you know, digestive core stability, other aching pains, you know, hip problems and things like that, that can really come from this instability through the core. And I love how you spoke about that, how our body is accumulation of our experience in the world.
Yes. Which begins in utero, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that, you know, there is so much more, you know, body-based therapies that are really seeing this connection between working from the body to help access the cortex or to help process if there is trauma.
Mm-hmm. And this is where I get a little bit excited
mm-hmm.
about occupational therapy in our role mm-hmm. here, because we have such an intimate understanding of sensations
mm-hmm.
and not from the cognitive perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so many body psychotherapies connect you to your understanding of what you sense. But I'm kind of biased, come way underneath that and give you the sensations.
Mm-hmm.
And give you the sensations in a reorganized way. So that not only are you thinking what you're feeling, but you're actually feeling it differently.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so many of the psychotherapies, because of their professional training, they don't have the gift of being able to put their hands on people like we do.
Mm-hmm.
So we are in such a beautiful position to use touch,
mm-hmm.
to use movement, to use sound
mm-hmm.
in ways that perhaps other professionals may not have within their ease of their practice act.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, when you think about the hierarchy of getting into the body,
mm-hmm.
there's different levels. Mm-hmm. And I've, you know, as a recipient of body psychotherapy myself,
mm-hmm.
I have to feel safe in the sensation
mm-hmm.
before I can believe
mm-hmm.
that cognitively I'm okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Here.
Yeah. I like to, in some of my workshops, show, and I'm sure you've used this tool too, the pyramid of learning
yeah.
by Williams and Schellenberger, just to sort of show at the core, at the base of the pyramid are our sensory systems. Obviously we layer in and talk below that in terms of our central nervous system, and I've actually added another layer in terms of our DNA predisposition and epigenetics, but our sensory systems lay the foundation of and helping us know who we are and how we become integrated beings. Definitely. And I'm so glad that you've included posture and expanded instead of just people thinking, well, I know when somebody's depressed that they seem to care, but it's so much more than that in terms of...
Well, one of my other teachers that I adore is one of the founders of a process called Bodynamics, and her name is Dita Marker, and she's from Denmark. Mm-hmm. And this theory, Bodynamics, originated like in the 60s and 70s, and it started to look at developmental movements in relationship to emotional development. So if traumas happened, which they do to every one of us, at different times in our childhood, it would hijack or affect different muscle groups, the muscle groups that were developing at that stage. And this theory has been very interesting for me in looking at, you know, if it happened to you when you were 4 months old versus 3 years old, that you were developing different coordination functions neurologically at that time, that it would show up in different muscles. And so this has been very interesting to me, because sometimes we go to correct a psychological, but if that energy is held in a muscle and I don't change the way that muscle works, the whole neural network doesn't change. And so it's really understanding how sometimes certain muscles get overused. I'm a very good example, elevating my shoulders. Mm-hmm. And others get completely deactivated. Mm-hmm. So we have to relax some and activate others.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. I'll have to check that out. And I'm just going to layer another little bit of learning that I've definitely recently sort of come across as just through some of my own body work. You know, I certainly understood the whole concept of our fascial system. Yes. But I've had this niggling little sort of hip issue, which has been holding me back from running. And I've been doing all the traditional interventions. And then I recently met a bodywork therapist who works with the fascial system, because I knew I needed myofascial release. But she actually worked and was and has been sharing her knowledge that about we have these fascial slings. So that was So I've only just started to learn a little bit, but just another way of how our body is connected, and the touch that taps into these fascial slings is incredibly light, which is, you know, we often talk about with our self and self protocol that less is more, and this kind of body work is definitely less is more to tap into our fascial systems, which will be curious to see how that layers on top of the body dynamics, because we do hold in different experiences in our body. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Thank you for sharing that. I hope this one isn't going to put you on the spot a little bit, but you are a master storyteller, Kim. You know, you have some amazing stories to share, and I don't know if you have one that you could sort of you think sort of connects this idea of body posture sensory.
Sure.
Yeah. Excellent.
I mean, I can even think about my colleague Theo, who is a Olympic gold medal athlete, who is such a contradiction. And why it's important to have this conversation is, here is a highly coordinated Olympic athlete with very distinct sensory motor issues. That now that the activity of being a professional athlete is no longer there, all of the other layers of sensory sensitivity and motor inactivation is really in the front and center. So when his, I'm going to use the word sensory diet, was no longer available, the emotion, all of the coping strategies were dissolved. And now there's chronic pain.
I just interrupt just to clarify, because I know some people might be thinking, what do you mean by sensory diet and what does that mean for him? So, I'm going to add the excessive exercise and training, but was there anything else you wanted to add on top of that?
Well, I think about his story as such a great example because he calls himself prenatal pharmaceutical disorder. His mom was a Valium addict, and in utero he would have had very high levels of exposure to Valium, which is the neurotransmitter GABA. And GABA is a sedative, and what it does is when it's high, your intrinsic dopamine production plummets. So you would be forming in your mom's tummy without the same dopamine activating circuits. That sets you up for so many challenges in how your brain is going to regulate itself. So then when he was born, his mom was chronically depressed. So he had his supply of GABA cut off, which meant high, high levels of irritability and withdrawal with an emotionally unavailable caregiver, no soothing, minimal soothing, and looked a lot like ADHD. So, as the more I read about ADHD, I did that with my fingers in chuk-chuks for the podcast. It's such a misunderstood diagnosis because it's such a soup of multiple factors, neurobiologically and energetically in the brain, that is about dysregulation. So when he stepped out on the ice at age 5, he was good at it. And there was a huge influx of dopamine, both from the reward and the moving your body against resistance, which is the sensory diet. So all of that pharmacy inside the brain was finally like, yes, this is how it's supposed to feel, to be in a just right state. And so that builds on itself, right? You want more and more and more of that. And so then that, kind of masks the pieces that are missing. And he would tell you, he was great on the ice. When he was off the ice, he was a disaster because that chemistry doesn't hold. So, back to your earlier question of what happens when those things, when you look at a story of how those things are important, that's that sensory backdrop was an incredible regulator that was a survival mechanism. And now that is not, well, it is there again because he's had to find new ways to capture that. And that's been a very big part of his continuous journey. So we all will have to find our own self-care to sustain all of the individual parts of ourself that become affected by our own experiences of individualized trauma. It's an individual recipe for each person.
And I like how you said in the beginning when you started to tell the story that he was, his sympathetic drive, what was keeping the momentum going. And it was, that could also be seen for people who have addictions, the high achievers, people who never stop, even mums who are constantly on the go, overly, having their kids scheduled and everything, they're involved in school, work, they're just the go, go, go. And it's when they stop is when things start to fall apart. Yes. So our sympathetic mobilization system helps us keep the momentum going, but we don't get to work with and take care of what's layering underneath.
Right.
Yeah. And then it has the consequences because you can't keep going in that.
And he would say it wasn't safe to be in rest.
Yes, yeah.
So for him, his abuse would happen. He was sexually abused as a young man, and it was always just before he went to sleep. So when you think about rest and restore, or dropping into a place where I'm in connection with myself, which would be to me the just right state, that was not a safe place. So you would move into sympathetic to avoid that space that you're talking about of comfort, because comfort meant danger. So you have to rewire that, right? That rest is actually supposed to be a good thing and a place where I can feel safe. Such a very uncommon thing in our current era.
So when he stopped his, his sensory diet in terms of the excessive training, what kind of things sort of showed up in his sensory system?
Significant anxiety was number one. So panic attacks, anxiety attacks, which were precipitated by sensory triggers. So smells, sounds, especially sounds, touch, certain types of clothing. These were things that were not there when the excessive exercise was part of his day-to-day life. It was kind of sitting underneath the surface. I invited Theo one time to come and see some kids with autism with me. He always said, "What do you do the rest of the time when you're not hanging out talking about trauma?" And one of his awarenesses is, "Wow, I think I have a lot of these qualities." And the qualities he was speaking about was the sensory system sensitivities, vigilance, over-orientation, and high levels of sensitivity. And that was not known to him. He loves his weighted blanket, his weighted vest, his weighted baseball cap. Those are different movements and modalities that he uses all the time. And, he had to go back to exercise, but one of the biggest problems was pain. Because his inner core stability, I'm talking about you now, Theo, is really poor. So exceptional activation of the limb girdles for hockey, but between the rib cage and the pelvis, not so good. And that has been a big source of challenge in his spine for a lot of pain. And those pieces have now come into the foreground of his attention.
Thank you for making that connection between adult trauma and sensory, and the sensory challenges that, that are evident in autism. And I think it kind of brings us back to what we're talking about in the beginning of looking at the neurobiology of what's happening in the underlying nervous system that can be common amongst different presentations. And getting back to what we're talking about as the base of the core, that our sensory systems lay that foundation. And it's something that we need to be tuned into because it's part of all our being. It's part of our biology. And I'm correct me if I'm wrong. I know in the past, but I don't know if I saw it on your workshop. I know you've done a workshop in the past where you unravel the neurobiology of autism. Are you still offering that workshop?
Yep. You know, it's an interesting question when people say, what workshops do you do? Because I'm such an enigma in that when people say to me, you know what, I really want to learn this. Will you try and put this together for us? Mm-hmm. So for example, I'm doing a really thorough, hopefully, upcoming workshop on sleep, which for me has been a very deep dive neurobiologically, putting together all the pieces related to sleep. So when you think about all the different things, why I've got that book, Why We Sleep, right?
Yes.
Right? So it's putting these pieces together. Mm. And essentially, I think for me, it's got to do with the fact that as an occupational therapist, we look at things holistically. Mm. So the neuro, it was called Decoding Autism. And, you know, it was the last workshop that I did in person just before COVID-19 hit in March here in Canada. But it has been a global workshop looking at all the different interactions of the system of autism. And wow, that can keep you very busy in the research field. So
definitely. And I'm glad that you're doing one on unraveling sleep, because I've done a few neuroplasticity workshops, and I have a segment where I talk about sleep, and it's primarily from the work from Matthew Walker's book, which you can tell from his reading the passion that he has for the topic. Mm. And yeah, I think it's another big layer, the piece of the puzzle for helping people. So,
well, and they're saying in the reading that I'm doing right now, mm. is it ADHD or is it sleep?
Yeah.
Is it autism or is it sleep? Is it dementia or is it sleep? Is it Parkinson's? Is it sleep? Like the overlap, it just again reinforces the mm-hmm. interaction mm-hmm. of the neurobiology with so many different pathologies.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe that should be our next talk, Kim. Because I know I definitely are a big plug for people to tune into sleep, because I think, you know, from my reading, probably not as extensive as yours, it's pretty much I've just read Matthew Walker's book. It just so much brain rejuvenation happens during sleep, and if it's impacted, it can, yeah.
Housekeeping for the brain.
Yeah, definitely. Perfect. Well, that could be another conversation for us. So we've covered a lot of information that I know you cover in this workshop. Was there anything you think that maybe we didn't?
Well, I really wanted to say thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about this workshop, because we are about to release it as a purchasable series, and the timing is lovely, and I'm really grateful to you. So that people can come to the website, my website, I can hardly say that, see, kimbarthel.ca, and they can see, you know, that this training is available for people.
More than my pleasure. I love your work. I love the information you share. I think it's so relevant and it's so helpful. So I learn a little bit more every time that we talk. So it adds more layers to my learning, which I just love. Yeah. So we'll put links in the show notes to your website and where people can find out more information. They can access your different workshops, and I look forward to us having more talks in the future. Thanks again.
Thank you so much, Joanne, for all that you do, for the people that you support and work with, and all of your passion and what you do for our profession.
I'm sure you're the same, that when you get a little message from somebody who has tuned in to, I just got one this morning, an hour before we met, I got somebody through LinkedIn, which I don't get often many through LinkedIn. And this, because I've been doing a webinar through the Australian Psychological Society, just talking about polyvagal and some of the other tools like the Staffenstein Protocol and heart rate variability biofeedback. And I just got this lovely message this morning saying that they tuned in, they enjoyed it, that they're loving the podcast, that they're learning so much. So it makes you feel really good to know that people are learning and getting value from the information you're sharing. So again, thank you for your time, Kim, and we'll speak again in the future. Have a great evening. All right.
Have a great day.
Yes. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Include a link in today's show notes. I'd love to hear from you, so please join and leave any comments or feedback via the Safe and Sound Protocol Podcast Facebook group or email me at sspodcast1@gmail.com. If you'd like to learn more about the Safe and Sound Protocol in Australia and New Zealand, please contact Integrated Listening Australia. The website is integratedlistening.com.au. And for the rest of the world, please contact Unite Integrated Listening at integratedlistening.com.